Today is the 25th of the 1st, 2017. I'm interviewing Doug Whitfield on his family in Hawke's Bay and other areas. Doug, would you like to tell me about your life and times?
Well, I guess if I go right back to my grandfather, he left England in the year 1900 and came to New Zealand on the toss of a coin. He walked down the street with my grandmother, who was 18. He was 20. And as he walked down the street, he saw a sign up, "Migrate to New Zealand." And he said to my grandmother, "Why don't we go there?" And she said, "Clem, we can't. We got no money." He said, "I've got 50 gold sovereigns," he said. So he pulled one out and he flipped it. He said, "Heads, we go to New Zealand. Tails, we stop here." And he took his hand off, and up it came his heads. So he went in and bought the ticket.
What a great start.
And that was in 1900, and they arrived on the Wellington Wharf. And that was, I think he used to tell us, that was the year that Richard Seddon died. And he died on the ship coming out. And when they got to the Wellington Wharf, the Maori people were wailing on the wharf. And my grandmother had never seen a coloured person, and she thought they were going to eat her. So she wouldn't get off the boat. So anyway, they got a job in Wellington working for Mr and Mrs Hannah, Hannah's shoe shop. And he was a coachman, and Grandma worked in the house cleaning for Lady Hannah. And anyway, he worked there for over a year. His coachman used to take her to town wherever she wanted to go and do a bit of gardening for her. Anyway, one day she came to him and she said, "Clem, I want you to clean my windows." And him being quite an arrogant pom, he said, "Mrs. Hannah, do you think I've come 14,000 miles to be a charwoman for you? You can stick your job." And he went and told Grandma, and she said, "Well, where are we going to live?" So he went and got her a job at Government House, cleaning at Government House with accommodation provided. And he went down to the West Coast coal mining. Yeah. He was down there for 2 years, and they never saw each other for 2 years while he worked there. And when he got enough money together, he came back up to Wellington, picked her up, and on their bikes they went out to Lower Hutt, a puny hamlet, Lower Hutt. And there he bought 2 acres. And he put glass houses up, and he grew vegetables, and took them into the Wellington market. So he bought the 2 1/4 acres, and he set it up as a market garden. And he used to go up into Wellington to the market gardeners. He became a part owner in market gardeners, put money into market gardeners to sell his produce. And he used to go with his horse and cart on the Hutt Road into Wellington, and then come back to Naranga and pick up horse manure and take it and put that on the garden. And he did that for 3 years, and then it must have been like 1910, I'm only guessing these figures, but he already had my father and my uncle, they were 2 little boys, and he decided he wanted to get out of the hut. So he got on a train and came up to Hawke's Bay, and a guy by the name of White had 6 acres for sale on Hodgson's Road at Parkaway. So Grandad bought a bike in Hastings and biked out to Parkaway to see this land and bought it. That was the start of Parkaway. And that one must have been about 1910, sure. I would think. And I'm only guessing that. It might have been later than that. It might have even been 1915, because the day of the earthquake in 1931, they were all digging potatoes by hand, and the big sacks, and my grandma was picking them up, and Dad and Grandpa were digging with a fork, and the bags all fell over, and they hadn't sewed them up. And that was the day of the earthquake. So that was down at, he bought 6 acres in Hodgson's Road in about 1915 maybe. And then later on he bought 10 acres down Brookfields Road. And that was where they were digging potatoes the day of the earthquake. Right. So that's where we started on potatoes. And so then Dad went on growing potatoes every year. Gradually got mechanised to the horse cultivator and then the digger behind the Fordson tractor. And we gradually got mechanised. And then Uncle Harry, Dad's brother, went over to Mill Road and Clive. He started growing over there. And then in 1938 I was born, and that was the day that he got the truck. And we've been involved in growing ever since. And then when in 1987 that Dad died, and my brother and I carried on for another 2 years growing. And we had quite a bit of land at Parkaway. We bought over the years, and we had an orchard as well. but my brother didn't like the orchard, so we cut that out, and we then grew just potatoes and pumpkins and tomatoes for Waddies. And then I go back a bit, during the war, Dad grew for the forces cabbage and all that sort of stuff, and as well as potatoes. So growing's been in, but we've always been in Parkawa. We started in Hodgson Road because Dad bought from Grandad that block, and he bought him a 3-acre block in Parkawa Road opposite Butte Orchards in town. And Grandma and Grandpa moved up there, and Dad got married to my mother, who was a Parkawa girl, and her father had an orchard on the corner by the store.
What was their name?
Harris. Yeah, and Johnny Harris had cows up the road. And anyway, they got married and lived in the house in Hodgson Road. And where I lived further up Hodgson Road, we bought another 14 acres in a house. And I bought that off Dad and got married in 1961.
Well, just go back to your schooling. You would have gone to school in Parkawa?
Parkawa School. Started there. I was born in 38. So I must have started there about 42, 43. And then went through to 1952 at Parkawa. In 1952, I went to Boys High in Napier, and I was there 52, 53, 54, and 55.
It was quite a little community, wasn't it? Centred around the community hall that was there.
Well, the hall was shifted, of course. The hall used to be Inferno's paddock on the corner there, and then they shifted it to where it is today. It's still the same hall.
There's not many of the names on the road now. They've all almost gone.
Well, we've got one, my boys there. Malcolm McDonald's there, and he's still on the main road. Brian Dillon, and that's it.
So anyway, you went to Napier Boys High.
Well, I did 3 years. I missed my school cert because I was spending most of my spare days at Frankstein driving machinery. And then my mother thought I was too small to lift these big sacks of spuds, and so she arranged for me to have an apprenticeship as a builder. So I went for 4.5 years into town till 1959. I finished my apprenticeship with Fortner Construction Company. Good. And my first day at work was on the fertiliser works in Awatata. And I started on there, and then we built a big part of Waddy's factory. And then after the fire, we built some more. We built Williams and Kettle. That's got pulled down. We're now on the corner of St Albans Street there, where they're all there. I'm trying to think of all those shops in there. We built for Loan and Mercantile. And then the day that I finished my apprenticeship, the boss came to me and he said, "You got 2 weeks to go and you'll be finished your apprenticeship." I said, "Well, can you take 2 weeks' notice then?" He said, "What?" I said, "Well, I don't want to be this. This is not my scene." I was fed up with the unions and the strife, and I didn't like it, and the lazy, and the way that people dodge work. And so as soon as I... So anyway, 59, we had a very, very wet spring. And I finished my apprenticeship in 59. And I came home and my father said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I finished. I'm coming home to you." And he just lost all the potatoes that he planted. The flood had taken them. They're rotten in the ground.
It was terrible that spring.
Anyway, he said, "I'm not getting any more seed. I'm not spending any more money." So I said to my mother, "Have you got any money?" And she said, "Yeah, I've got some saving." I said, "How about lending it to me?" So she lent me £2,000. And I bought seed and fertiliser, leased the neighbour's property across the road, McCann's, and I planted spuds in there. And when I did that, Dad went and bought some more seed, and he planted his crop as well. And that was 1959. And anyway, so we struck out together, and I worked for Dad for those years, but I also worked for myself. And that was from 1959 to 61, when I got married. And then Gwen and I worked on our own and helped Dad. And then finally we made a company, so it became J.R. Whitfield and Sons Limited, and that was my father and my brother and I. Yep. And we farmed that till Dad died, and then we changed it to my name, and my brother left. Yep. So that was how it all happened. So I started big time in spuds in 1959, and we got up to, the biggest we got up to was 600 acres, 400 acres in Hawke's Bay, and 200 acres at Awakuni.
And of course you were in potatoes when we were in the big sacks.
Yeah, 14 to the ton. How I've got it back, I don't know. And then in 1959, the day I come home, or that year, Dad bought the first Ferguson 35 diesel, and we were able to put a forklift on it. And from there, we started the pallets. Even though we didn't have bins, we just started the pallets. And we used to stack the sugar bags on the pallets and lift them on with the 35 Fergie. And that was a big step from the farmers that had no hydraulics like the first.
Well, you know, you think back when you were tomato growing and we used to stack all the boxes on the truck, not on pallets.
I never did that. When we started growing tomatoes, was about 1963 and was on pallets and on a big trailer. Mm. And we'd go down the paddock and load the tomatoes onto the four pallets on the trailer, come out to the hill and then forklift them with the old forklift over your shoulder onto the truck and then take them to Waddy's. I used to work alongside Ned Erickson doing that. Our spud game was our number one, and gradually we bought our first harvester from Gisborne, and that would have been about 1963-64, Johnson Minor, and it was no good, so we took it back. We brought it down on the old A5 Bedford, and then I carted it all the way back, and then I went over to Martin and bought a Johnson Major, which was a big improvement on that on my job. So we started with that, and then from there we went to Grim Harvesters. Early days, of course, we hand-picked with Mary Gang. The same gang that picked our tomatoes picked our spuds into big sacks, and we'd just cart them to the shed, take them too high in these big sacks, and never sew them. Yeah. And then we'd push the grader and just tip them in. 1976 was a big change for us. We got in tow with Turner's guys from Hamilton, who we had been supplying, and they started some shops called K-Market. And they were fruit and vegetable outlets, and they had one in Hamilton, in Kaikadea Drive, one in Rotorua, and one in Huntley. And we bought a new truck and trailer to cart spuds to them in 1976. Brian Dale was the guy. He was an auctioneer for Turner's. That's who I dealt with. And him and Paul Fear had a fallout with Turner's, and they went on their own. And that's when we started 76, and later on it would be, in the very early 80s, we started growing it over again. Because we had to have spuds all year round. And when we couldn't dig in Hawke's Bay, we could dig in Aokini, because they're getting all the rain today. I've just been talking to my mate over there. They've had 30 mils last night, and we're not getting a drop.
We used to grow some ruas for the canneries.
Well, because ruas were one of the worst. Unless you had absolutely dead tops, dry, and good wet ground, they'd bruise as easy. Oh. And they go in and grit a grey bruise. Yeah. And we persevered with ruas, and our first two-row harvester, I said to my brother, we can't use this thing on these ruas. So we went back to hand-picking and digging.
Yes, we grew a potato, Majestics.
Yep. And my son-in-law, his father used to grow the seed at Kimbolton, Pritchard, Jacob Pritchard. Yeah, well, his son is married to my daughter. They met each other through us in the potato game. Yeah, he was up at the back of Appity. He grew spuds, put them down and graded them and field him.
You were growing up to 600 acres.
That was where we picked. And that was in Waddy's owned the factory at Fielding, and we grew 200 acres for them for process, and that all went in bulk tipping trucks and bins. And then when that fell over, McCain's bought the factory and only run it for a year or two and then closed it down, and we then had to find alternative markets. And that's when we pushed hard with these K-boys. They put some more shops at Tauranga and Te Awamutu, and they started taking pretty well half our crop. And we then put it in 1995, Ross was home, and we went to Australia and bought a new truck, a big truck, 550 horsepower. He's just got rid of those trucks now, got new ones. But that truck came on here with a B train behind it and went out every night to Auckland or somewhere loaded with spuds. And the Eagle that I've got in town getting repainted, it used to go to Auckland every Monday morning or Sunday night, and every Thursday, and that was the Turners in Auckland.
So, with your Ohakuni growing, did you have staff over there?
Yeah, and a manager over there, and he got the staff, and then I used to go 2 days a week. I'd go over on Tuesday night and usually stay. We had a flat in the shed. We built a flat like a bit bigger than this. And I'd stay there, and I'd help him on Wednesday and Thursday and just help him with the digging. But at that time, we were growing potatoes for washing. And we were washing at Levin. We were tied up with Wilcox's from Pukekohe, and we used to grow 500 tonne for them for washing. And they had to be Nardine and Reds, and so Stroma and Nardine were the varieties we grew for them. And that's when our All International used to go two nights a week down to Levin from Ohakuni.
Because out of the soil up there, they would come out almost clean.
They were only on a very light wash. And what we did over there, we also grew our seed. We stopped buying seed from the South Island, and we grew seed there and certified it. And then we could sell that as well. We used to sell it to our Pukekohe growers, and they'd come straight out of their paddock and be shipped up to them, already in bins, and they'd plant them early. And over there we grew a bit of rua, we grew nardine, and then they were supplying a couple of factories, so we grew russet Burbank, which is a big long bun. So we grew the seed for that for 5 or 6 years. So that was an interesting operation. And then Moonlight came on board, which is a New Zealand variety, and we carried on growing that. And Trevor Good, out here, used to buy the seed of us. We'd grow it at Awakini, bring it over here and grade it, and he'd take it. So those were the later years of our growing operation.
So the sheds you had at Parkaway, were they purpose-built or were they farm sheds?
They started off as purpose-built, and then they grew like topsy. We just kept adding on to them as we got bigger and bigger. But they were never high enough. We were trying to skimp, and we got those trusses from, I forget, one of the firms in town, Cyclone. They made these frames, and we met them, and they weren't really high enough, but we managed with them. We'd store 1,000 tonne at Parkaway.
And of course, I suppose, Ohakuni, because it's cooler, you probably weren't worried about stuff like blight.
No, frost was our biggest problem. We had a frost 1 year on Christmas Day, and I knew it was coming because the temperatures were dropping. And my manager rang me and he said, the temperatures are coming down. And I said, ring the helicopter, get them to put 2 kilo to the hectare of copper on. And that would give us 2 degrees we could save, and we never got cut. And our next door neighbour's spuds were brown, and ours weren't even touched, just with 2 kgs of copper. So they just hardened the top a wee bit. Yeah, Awakini was different. We wouldn't plant till we'd finished planting here. We took the gear, the planter and all from here. We always had a couple of tractors over there. But we took the planter and the hopper and all that gear, and we'd go and plant. And we'd start planting about 5th or 6th of December. And if we had a good run, we'd get all in by Christmas. But if we didn't, we might have to plant a bit after Christmas. But that wasn't desirable because we had frost in the autumn at the other end. But it was a very interesting soil over there to work, very easy to work. Turned it over the plough. A lot of the ground we got was ground that had been swedes and that sort of thing. So we just go in and plough it, give it one cup of the power hour and plant. And the other ground we got was new ground, and we got that ahead of the carrot growers. And they wanted us in first so that there was no turf in the ground because the carrots would fall.
Yeah.
So they wanted ours. So we had the ground first.
And of course, as time went on, your children grew, and it's your son that's in the trucks. Did he ever work as a potato grower?
He went and worked from... He did his apprenticeship with Russell Ashfelts, the Russell boys, as a mechanic. I said to him, if you're going to be doing trucks, you've got to have knowledge to fix them.
Yeah.
So he went off. The older boy, that's the boy on the tractor there, he didn't want to leave home. He came home the day he was 15, and he worked with us on the spud all that time. He did most of the tractor work.
So what's his name?
John. And he now works for his brother-in-law, Alan Clark, who owns Bay Spray and do all the roads. Yeah, and that's my son-in-law, mother's son-in-law. And John works for him, and he also works for Stuart Young. Since I've got Crook, he's doing Stuart Young's potato work, which I used to do.
And then, of course, along came Sillet.
It cost us $1 million. We didn't know we had it. We must have had 300 acres of spuds here in the bay by that year. And I wondered why they were going like they had blight, the tops. They only got that high.
Yeah.
And because we were growing a lot of moonlight then, which are very susceptible to one of the worst. And anyway, the next thing we heard that the psyllid had come in on capsicums in Auckland, Pukekohe. It was spread like wildfire through the country. And people could only grip little wee spuds and tomatoes. And I'll never forget that first year, the bank rang me up and they said, you can clear your overdraft. I said, I can't. It's impossible. I said, if we had $1 million worth of spuds in the ground, we'd be lucky if we get 100,000 out of them. So anyway, it was a very challenging thing because we've been using a product called Tamron for tube moth, and we never started spraying for tube moth until probably the 20th of December, depending on the season. Anyway, I read an article, Gwen, my late wife, she got onto the computer and found out that North America had plenty of psyllid. And they started spraying when they were only that high. So we had a bit of seed left over in the shed, and the crop had gone, they were gone. And so what are we going to do? So on 20th of January, I got these spuds out of the shed, and I planted them. And the other crop were all damaged with psyllid, you see. And we started spraying them when they were just through the ground. We sprayed every week with Metaford and oil, vegetable oil. And I got 25 tonne to the acre in April. Not a mark on, and that was in right through the heat of the summer. And here we were paying all these researchers to do all this research about silage, and they were creaming it, and they couldn't come up with any answers. And all it was, you had to get in and impregnate the plant with this early. Now I still do it. And we don't use any of the flash sprays. We just use a state-of-the-art Metaphor and all.
I bought two or three different sorts of chemicals they sold me. Now, it cost more to spray them than if I had to go into the supermarket and bought them new.
Well, that's the thing, and that's why their chemicals that they were recommending were so expensive. And the other thing we had to learn was you had to get down to the bottom of the plant. And high pressure is no good because all it does is fog. So we went back to low pressure and big droplets. And we put glass in the bottom of the furrow and there were spots were on it. And we knew we were getting the bottom leaves because they were coming in and laying their little eggs on their bottom leaves and then all these nymphs would get underneath. They'd suck the guts out of the plant. You see, helicopters were useless. We get the volume on. Well, we still today sprayed 400 litres to the hectare. And we got a John Deere with two tanks up on the bottom and one on the back, 500, 500. Thousand on the back.
Do you still grow any spuds?
We all grow all for the Chinese, just China.
Well, for Xu Young, where does he grow?
All around the place, and we do all his work. I've still got my big sprayer with a 20-row boom and all hydraulic, and we built that ourselves. And we've changed the nozzles, and we're having big droplets, and we've beat the silage. And we're digging agri now.
Aren't they a great spud?
Oh, yeah. We planted the first paddock of agri this year on the 20th of August, and they're beautiful.
So who does the work on your tractor for Stuart then? You don't?
Not at the moment. I did it all at Tiger City. John's doing it. He knows all about it. So we spray for him, we plant for him, we mould for him, and we harvest for him.
Oh, so you've still got a grim?
Yeah, a little old grim. It's got two new webs for it.
Now, you consistently got high tonnages, but from all sorts of varieties of potatoes, didn't you?
Yeah. I always said you had to have 50 to 60 tonne to the hectare, which is over 20 tonne. And my father taught me how to do my estimates years and years ago. He said, you plant a seed potato like that, you use a tonne to the acre. And when you want to have a look at how you got there, you take all them out, and those big spuds, three of those, and that's how he worked out his stuff. As easy as. So I still do that.
Now, Doug, you also had a long-term involvement with the New Zealand Growers Federation, or whatever it was called.
Yeah, well, the Vegetable Growers Federation, originally the potato industry was tied up with Federated Farmers, and when I got to know this Alan Pritchard, and that was only because my father went on a holiday and met him, and so he came back and he said to me, I met a guy, Pritchard, he's on the potato board. Now, the potato board was under the umbrella of Federated Farmers. The job of the potato board was to know that New Zealand had enough potatoes stored in pits in the South Island to supply the New Zealand market. Well, Alan Pritchard retired and he asked me to go and be the member. So I went to be the member on Federated Farmers, and we used to meet in the St. George Hotel in Wellington once or twice a year. And after 3 years, VegFed was already going, and Jim Clayton in Parker White was already chairman of the early potato committee of VegFed. One day he stopped me on the road, he said, what are you doing? He said, all potatoes need to be under VegFed. They don't want to be under Federated Farmers. I said, well, I agree with that, Jim, but how can we do it? He said, well, we've got to convert the potato growers that they're best with VegFed rather than Federated Farmers. So there was a guy by the name of Lex Wilcox from AS Wilcox and Book Co. And he rang me up and he said, oh, VegFed have asked me to go and visit the potato growers of New Zealand. He said, I want you to come with me as the Federated Farmers one. He said, and we'll try and put them all in. Well, it was a wonderful opportunity. We toured the South Island and met every potato grower in the South. I was away for 2 weeks, and we came to the North Island and we did the same. And we got everybody under the umbrella of VegFed. And it was a little while after that they made me chairman of the potato industry. And up there on the top up there, that's my longest serving chairman of the potato industry, the yellow one with the gold around. So that was my involvement in the political arena. And then after I resigned from that, when two other guys came up, I pulled out. I then got made chairman of the Squash Council, and that was with Brownrigg, Bostock and Murray McPhail. And I started looking after squash, because by that time I was growing squash. So I was squash chairman for 9 years. and then I retired from all those sort of things. So I think I did 12 years as chairman of the potato industry and 9 years on the...
So you really put something back into the industry, didn't
well, they
you?
They awarded me that award, and out of that I got a holiday to Fiji as well, and my wife and I. And my late wife died in 2012. And it was a big blow, but she'd worked with me. And I was away, she run the phones, because I was, you know, by that time my brother had left. He left in 1987, it went to town. And John was running the farm, and I was doing the exec. So yeah, it was a very interesting time. I learned a lot. I met a lot of very great people. And it was a great experience for me, but without, I've got it all recorded here, without my wife carrying on home, I couldn't have done it.
So what were some of the major changes you saw? I suppose a lot of it was machinery.
I think the machinery, when we went to the two-row harvester, big grimy two-row, we had two of them. The first one didn't have a very big bunker, and so you had to have a bin on a trailer beside you. And then the last one we owned had a 5-ton bunker, and we could go up the full length of the paddock, on a long paddock, and then have all the bins stacked along the headland and just empty into them. We had socks that came down like
really?
Bigfoot. And that was our aim. No trouble to do 130, 150 ton a day. And that would be just idling. I used to drive the tractor most on the harvester, most of the time. John did it a bit, but by that time my brother had gone, and we had this, bought this harvester for 140,000 in Australia, brand new, shipped it over here, a Grimmy. And oh, she was a great harvester. It's actually gone to Owakuni. I towed it from here to Owakuni,
right.
And he's digging spuds with it.
Right. I wonder what your father would think if he saw this. And well, your grandfather.
Well,
he
my
saw
grandfather the most. My grandfather never saw us do any more than hand picking. But my father saw the harvesters. By the time Dad was alive, we had three harvesters in his life. And when we went to bins, 1-ton bins, fascinated Dad that we could pick up a 1-ton bin, put it on the truck.
How many bins were the big trucks take?
Oh, our big truck cut a 24.
24 tonne
yeah,
spuds.
Yeah, yeah. We used to go to Auckland to Mr. Chips with that every year, or we do 3 days a week to Auckland. That's the international that I've got. And I'm rebuilding, it's done just under 3 million Ks. We bought that new in 1983, brand new, and it cost 154,000 in 83.
Think what it would cost now.
Yeah, well, Ross has just got a new one on the road. 300 and something thousand. The first international we bought was 75,000. We bought that in 1980. We only had it for 3 years, and then we bought the bigger one. That was 300 horsepower. The other one was 400 horsepower. And I've still got the one that's 400 horsepower. Yeah.
A big six?
Yeah, big six.
Big feet.
Oh, yeah, she goes.
And I see you've still got a few green tractors down here.
Yeah, I only got two. You got that one and the one with the sprayer on it.
Yes, I see you've got a blue one too.
Oh yeah, I bought that and I was going to restore it, but I haven't done it. But yeah, John Deere was there. Because my brother was at Massey Ferguson, we had the farmers, and then in 1959 we went to Ferguson.
Mm-hmm.
We bought a 4-cylinder, and the next year we bought a 3-cylinder 35.
Mm-hmm.
And they were our two tractors. Then we went from there. I think we bought a 165 with an exhaust on the left-hand side. And the next year we bought a 165 with a right-hand exhaust. It was a 212 unit. And then we bought two 168s, and they weren't much better than the 165. So then we bought two 188s. We had them for a couple of years, or 3 years, and then we bought a 595 French Ferguson with a cab, and a 295, and then went to 1086 International, and that was a disaster. And from there in 1987, we went to our first John Deere, two of them. And we've still got one of them on the sprayer, but the others have all gone. I've only got that one down here. We had a good run. We had 10 John Deere's in the peak. But you had to have them for the work you had to do.
Now, I know that you didn't take much part in any sports, but you did have a bit of a sporting run with a whole lot of other tractor enthusiasts when you drove from the North Island to the South Island. Tell us about that trip.
Well, my friend, Phil Aish, he lost his wife with cancer, and he made a promise to her that he would do something for hospice. And so he came here to see me. That's Phil there. Would I be interested? And I said, yep. So he told me what he wanted, the plan to do. So I went and found a 188 that had been restored, and it's in the shed down in the paddock down here. And I drove it from the Bluff to Cape Ringer.
So how did you take it to Bluff?
A crowd from Palmerston, PTS. Palmerston North Tractors Services. He has trucks going up and down the country all the time. and Gary Spence, rang him and he said, what would it cost us? The guy said, what are you doing this for? He said, for cancer. He said, we will take it to Invercargill for you, free, providing you get it ready in a fortnight. Because I needed a month before you want to drive it, so that I can slot it in with other loads. So he took it down for free. Gary's in my truck.
You know, that's a straight donation.
Well, we had an orchard here, a big orchard here, gave me $2,000 towards my trip. Like, we paid our own way on this trip, but we gave all the money that we got sponsored. Yeah. Brown Roof sponsored me, Bostock sponsored me, and I raised just about $8,000 in sponsorship. We raised $104,000 for hospice. It was a long trip. I was away for a month. Just this time last year, people said to me, because I was the oldest joker on the trip, we cannot believe how you don't even get tired. I said, well, I've been sitting in a saddle like this for hours and hours, half the night. You know, and I said, we're only doing 7 hours a day.
Was the Mercedes a local tractor?
No, he bought that, Phil had that. It was Phil's tractor.
Did he go?
Yeah, he went, yes. He drove it. Yeah, I didn't realise that half the jokers had cabs and I never had a cab. I just had a roof. But it didn't worry me. I enjoyed it, actually.
So, the future, you're still growing potatoes in a supervisory fashion, doing the work, but...
Not much work. I will be doing a bit of spraying on Saturday because my son, who does it, he's got to go to see his daughter in Gisborne. So I said, well, you go and I'll do the spraying on Saturday. Because, I mean, these modern gear we've got the liters per hectare, and we just set it at 400 and she bleeps the light. We're either going too slow or too fast.
Helix change, you know, with the GPS and all these things now.
We haven't got GPS. No. But we spray 20 rows at a time. We set our operation up with a 4-row planter. That was in 19, it would be, probably the late 19s. Or might have been about 1995. We bought a new 4-row planter. And then we put everything in 4-row. So we got, our molders have got 5 molders. And our Lewiston's got 5 Lewiston's. And then when we dig those two, and then those two. And if the joint is a bit out, it doesn't matter. And so we do everything. And then our sprayer goes down the centre 4, throttling the centre 2, and it sprays 9 rows out that side, and 9 rows out that side, so we get our 20 rows. So do 5 blocks of the planter.
The other thing that changed a lot, and that was irrigation.
Yeah. The irrigation, we started with pipes, and we used to shift them 24/7. And we'd back down the road when we wanted to shift them over. My wife used to back the 165 down the road with the lights on, so I could see to shift the pipes across. And we'd go bare feet up to here and shifting them. Well, then we bought our first irrigator was a Briggs, and it was a big rotor range, and it winched up a clicker as it went round. And we used that for a few years. And then I went off to the South Island and I bought a Omi, what they call an Omi, which is a red one. It actually picks its hose up, 4-inch solid hose, as it goes down the paddock. That was a disaster in spuds, because if the paddock was sloping and the water run down, it would bog itself when they got the hose on. So I said to Leon Jansen, I said, I like the idea, but I'd rather go to the big gun. So he took me over to Aussie, and we saw these big guns working. And so I ended up with 5 of those, and that was the best thing we ever did. I've just sold the last one, the Parrot, to Stuart Young. But you could set them up and they would do 40 rows each side, 80 rows, and you just tow it down. And the hose was on the headland, and all you towed was the cart. And that was the biggest, because we couldn't, on leased land, that we couldn't get a pivot or anything jacked up. So that was the best irrigator we could have at the time. And it went well. But back to the Omi, I bought that Omi out in Darfield in the South Island. And I bought an old tractor and I towed it all the way to Christchurch from Darfield in the daytime. And then I sat till 2 o'clock in the morning and I towed it through the tunnel to get it on the boat.
It fitted all right?
Yeah, I got it through, but because you shouldn't be in there. Okay. So I got through that and I got to Littleton at the port and I booked to have it lifted on the ship the next morning. And then I sold the tractor to a tractor yard, then flew back home. I only shipped it to Wellington on the ferry. It was a ferry going just to Wellington. And then we took the truck down. Well, the boys met me in Wellington in the truck. And we had to hang the wheels over the edge of the deck. It's too wide. So we put blocks under the axle, sat it on the deck with a crane, put a big crane. And then we came all the way home and I piled in all the way home. We travelled all night with that one. But the Parrot was the best irrigator we had. And I've just got the last one. John and I just set it up the other day for sure.
Now, we need Deirdre to come in and tell us about her part of the...
It won't take long for her. She's only been around here 3 years.
Okay. Doug married Deirdre 3 years ago.
Yeah, 23rd of November 2013.
Now moving down to become urban dwellers in Hastings. Deirdre, would you like to tell me where you grew up, where your parents came from?
She's a Pom, really.
Yeah, but we all were once.
I was born in England, in Pembrey, Tunbridge Wells, Kent, during the war. My mother and father both came from, my father from Kent, my mother from London. My father was in the RAF, and also he was a policeman. When he left the RAF, he went into the Metropolitan Police in London, and he was in the flying squad. And then in 1953, the New Zealand government got him to come to New Zealand as the driving instructor for New Zealand Police. He left that and he went out as a minister. And then we came out here, we lived in Hamilton for 3 years and then we shifted down to Upper Hutt. I met my late husband in Upper Hutt, he was a butcher. But we married and lived in Masterton at Biddeford for the first 9 years of our life, married life on a sheep farm.
That's Falloon country, isn't it?
That's down the road from them. Then we left there and we went down to Dalefield in Carterton and we milked cows for 26 years.
So you're a cow copy?
Yes, I milked for them for, how many years did I say?
26.
Yes. And Ian died in 1999 and I kept the farm, but I shifted into town, into Carterton, but I didn't like living in town, and came up and lived in Dannyberg, bought a lifestyle block in Dannyberg. Then I sold the farm in 2005, and I stayed at Dannyberg till 2013. I was on the lifestyle block until 2012, and it got too much for me, so I went to town, and a year later, I met Doug.
So yes.
That's how it started.
Obviously started a lovely relationship.
Yeah, there. I've been on my own for over a year.
I've been on my own for 14 years.
So do you have any children?
I've got two daughters. One's in Carterton and one's in Morrisville.
Morrisville?
Where's the side of Masterton?
North of Masterton.
And so you moved from Dannyberg, you came up here, met Lord Fauntleroy.
I didn't meet him here, I met him in Dannyberg on a
blind date. I came down to see her in Dannyberg with my friend. And Taupo met her, he hadn't seen her for 50 years. And he told me about her, and I said, what's she like? And, and he gave me a good description. So I decided I'd bring her up, which I did. And I'd never seen her before, I didn't know what to expect. And I went down to Dannyberg on a Sunday, took her out for lunch, and from there it happened.
And now you're moving into the heartland of Miami, when you leave here.
I bought a container today. And I've got this lease farm up the Tybee Road, so I'm taking all my farm gear and putting it in that container, like all my fencing gear and drenching gear and my motorbike, and it'll stay on that farm.
Whereabouts?
It's just before Sheridan, not far away, less than half an hour from here.
Well, I think that's probably given us a pretty good look at various things that you've done, Doug and Deirdre.
If you want to have a read of that, you can take that with you. That'll be very interesting. It talks about my wife and my family and all in there.
All right, well, thank you very much for that opportunity of doing this.